everyone. It is Wednesday, February 12th. This is the day after the New Hampshire primary. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Lovely day in the neighborhood. Interesting election returns. We're going to be talking about variations on that theme all day. Just to let you know, and we're going to go right to Colonel Vindman in 2 seconds, because our lawless president-in-chief needs to be removed, and since we can't find enough Republican senators to remove him, we must remove him, and we are going to be playing Colonel Vindman's powerful testimony every single day between now and the election. But I will tell you that at some point in time, you might be hearing some voices that you've heard on this radio show. John Nichols of The Nation and Scott Braddock from Texas are also going to be in our studio dropping by. But before we do anything, once again, this is our day three. Colonel Vindman, every single day between now and the election, we need to remember Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself, and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago, and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. That was Colonel Vindman. We're going to be playing him every single day between now and the election. I am not going to let go of this. Remember Vindman, and especially in what happened just the other night. Oh God, I don't even know what to do. We have such a lawless president. All right, so let me set the stage for our first guest. And also, as I mentioned to you before, that John Nichols of The Nation magazine is going to be in our studio. In fact, he just arrived. Scott Braddock is also going to be joining us. They're just dropping in, but how could you not have these voices on the air as they drop in? And because I don't say it was an exciting election on Tuesday night. What I will tell you, however, is that it was an exhausting election on Tuesday night. And I do need to say that if nothing else, what we were able to do is rehabilitate what happened in Iowa. And what happened in Iowa was not only chaos and a lack of conclusion, because once it's a caucus, which I think is somewhat undemocratic, and two, because they were trying to somehow repair it from 2016, and then the Trump people jammed the phone lines and the app didn't work. I mean, it was a cacophony of failure on every single level. And as a result, New Hampshire was really important. But the most important thing I think about New Hampshire is that people turned out and voted. People turned out and voted. And that is the most important thing. I needed people to produce the numbers that were essential for this election. So the first thing we're going to do is welcome our first guest, who's actually on the line by phone. He knows the guy, John Nichols, in my studio who dropped by. And I want to welcome to the program Bill Curry. Bill Curry writes for Salon.com. Bill Curry was an advisor to Bill Clinton. Bill Curry ran for governor in the great state of Connecticut twice. And Bill Curry is probably one of the famous and most fabulous gets that we ever get on this radio program. So let me welcome to the program Bill. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty well this morning, climbing out from under the debris.
Yeah, from the debris, exactly. And as I mentioned, John Nichols is also here. Welcome to the program, John.
Oh, wow. Hi, John.
Hi, Bill. If you'll recall, I think we broke down the results to the 2016 election on the day after. So we seem to come together in these.
Yes, I vividly
moments.
Recall that.
Yes, I know you did. So I want to start with a comment. And this was just before the election. And I happened to have MSNBC on, Bill Curry. And here was the comment that I heard on MSNBC, that Bernie Sanders had flatlined at number one.
Yeah.
Let me just use that line. flatlined.
That's a wonderful line.
And I almost want a bumper sticker that says that. And the reason why I bring that up is that I was mentioning to John, I called him up this morning, and I said, John, we got to talk about this. In 2016, when Bernie pulled it out of his socks and shocked the world and defeated Hillary Clinton, a place that she has lived in since 1991. I mean, please understand this, that Clintons have never left New Hampshire. I think there's been someone on the payroll since 1991 in anticipation of Bill Clinton running again in 96, Hillary Clinton running again, and it didn't matter. They've been on the payroll and everyone knows them. So to have her lose to a progressive social Democrat, whatever he is, was shocking to everyone. But as a result of that, for the first time, the media paid attention to him. Was that a good news story for Bernie Sanders or a bad news story for Bernie Sanders? And what I'm going to tell you is, if Donald Trump got $2 billion in free media in order for him to make the win in 2016, you know what Bernie Sanders has gotten since 2016? Probably $1 to $2 billion in negative media or no media coverage. And when you begin to realize that and see what he's able to accomplish despite what the media has done to him, it is a phenomenal, phenomenal result on Tuesday. And I want people to know, if the media propped up Donald Trump, they tried to destroy Bernie Sanders. And guess what? It didn't work. Anyway, let me let you take the stage, but I just need to say this because I'm so upset. All right, Bill.
I've got a slogan for Bernie.
Okay.
Vote Sanders. There's just no other way to get the Clintons to go home.
In some ways, you're so right. Oh, my God. Your thoughts.
And again, I also say, somewhat in jest, and as the local Leon Trotsky figure here in Connecticut politics for so much of my life, so I never saw myself that way. I've been telling people the last few days that there are.
All right, wait a second. We're going to reconnect with you because you're going in and out, and I want to make sure that the quality of our conversation is good because I don't want to lose a word of Bill Curry. So I'm going to just pot you down and then bring John in until you come back. All right. So what's your thoughts after yesterday? Because you've been covering these campaigns for years.
Well, and in fact, I've covered Bernie Sanders for the better part of 30 years.
And, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and interviewed him probably about 500 times.
Yeah.
And look, here's the bottom line. Bernie Sanders was treated as sort of a cute figure.
Yes.
You know, like
exactly.
A sort of adorable.
Yes.
Right?
Adorable.
And he's a Vermonter up there. He's curmudgeonly and all that. He had the whole line on him for a very long time. And that's something that our media likes to do. They love you if you are on the margins. But when you come in from the margins mm-hmm. and become a part of the mainstream discourse, when mm-hmm. you literally mm-hmm. are defining the politics,
right.
Well, then you start to see kind of the heart and soul of our media.
Right.
And Bob McChesney and I wrote a book about this a few years ago. And one of the things that we were struck by is we looked at what they did to Howard Dean back in 2004, long before the scream. They were policing him.
Yeah.
Literally running headlines. Is he too crazy to be president?
Right.
Stuff like that. That's the vital thing to understand. Bernie Sanders, once he came to a position of being viable, became someone that needed to be policed.
Yeah.
And they continue to police him.
Right. But Bill Curry, you're back on the line with us. Thank you so much. And I'm not even sure it's even policing. Policing sounds like you're putting parameters on Bernie Sanders. They don't put parameters on him. They don't even allow him on their set. They don't include him in the conversation. And if they do, he is trashed, Bill.
The condescension of the entire establishment of the Democratic Party, which includes the two cable news networks.
Oh, Bill, wait a second. Bill, I don't know what's going on, but there is something wrong with our phone lines or your phone line.
Can you hear me now?
It's not about hearing you. It's about there's actually a quality issue with the phone line. Maybe we'll try you on a different line from our studio and see if it's our line or yours. I just can't lose you, all right?
Okay.
You go. All right, go on. Keep going. So yeah. I guess my question to you is that, you know, Bloomberg is going to buy his campaign. Bernie is going to not only have to take on the Republican Party, not only Bloomberg and his billions, but the billions and billions of dollars in the national media. And yet, despite that, what does Elizabeth Warren say? He persists.
Well, she persists, too, and give her credit for that. Look, here's the bottom line on all of this. Bernie Sanders said 5 years ago, mm-hmm. when he was deciding whether to run, And I remember when he said it, I did the cover story on The Nation that said he might run for president. And one of the things he said, which seemed almost like a casual throw-off line, was, well, the only way I'll ever win is if there's a political revolution. And this has become such a part of it. But boy, back then it just seemed like, oh, that's the kind of thing you say.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
He didn't expect
exactly.
to move to a position. I think Bernie Sanders himself has been surprised by much of what has happened. And so this concept, now I understand that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
It is a political revolution if he prevails. It is a media revolution.
Exactly.
And one of the things that is important about Bernie Sanders, Bob McChesney and I, when we started the media reform movement, free press and these groups.
Right.
At our first conferences, Bernie Sanders spoke. He is the only politician, one of the handful of politicians, Sherrod Brown's another, who got that media is an issue.
It is
that
huge
how media
issue.
Operates is an issue. And people think of him as somebody who attacks the media. I think of him as the opposite. Bernie Sanders is perhaps the most ardent defender of journalism in our political class.
Mm-hmm.
There are a handful of others who are very good too. But he really wants a lot of journalism.
Oh,
he
God,
does
don't
not,
we all?
But he doesn't mind being asked a tough question.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you see him on these cable shows, it's fascinating. Now that he actually is being invited on the shows, like the Sunday morning shows, the questioner can never get the question out because he – knows where the question's going. And so they've got like the first line and he goes, okay, I know what you're asking.
Exactly.
But that isn't somebody who's being arrogant or pushy. That's somebody with deep understanding of the media, how it works.
Right.
And this – he is a great challenge for our media system as well as our political system. And nothing will be given to him ever.
All right, so Bill, let's hope that the connection is good. I got my fingers crossed. Speak to me. So here's my question to you. One of the things that people keep saying is, well, Bernie got there, but he really hasn't been vetted. So, you know, Elizabeth Warren was asked a lot of the tough questions, like how you would do it. And she was given some time, and she's the one that says she's a capitalist, and Bernie says he's a democratic socialist. Did the media actually hurt themselves if they think that Bernie is such a challenge and that he isn't good for America? By not allowing him to participate the way the other candidates were given time on the set, by not asking him on the TV set with MSNBC and CNN and ABC the tough questions, to have him answer that if they thought there was weakness to his arguments, they never even allowed it to be exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a funny way, by sort of somehow not giving him FaceTime, they actually elevated him, especially to his base. But more importantly, they didn't give a sense of analysis about what he was saying that, frankly, he deserved.
So let's break that good question up into a couple parts. First off, I don't know somebody who's been the mayor of the largest city in their state, a member of Congress, and a member of the U.S. Senate, serving at the federal level for now – 30 years.
Right.
I kind of think that's a little insulting to the voters of Vermont to say that he hasn't been vetted. The fact of the matter is he's actually been, you know, through tough races. He beat a Republican incumbent.
You're not hearing me. You're not hearing me. What I'm saying
is – I'm hearing everything you're saying.
No, Vermont is the size of a suburb, $600,000. And
$600,000
voters, and the problem I have is that not only does he have only 600,000 voters, but they are so comfortable with him, they know him from being the mayor of Burlington, and there isn't a sort of there isn't an aggressive media in Vermont. I mean, I love the Rutland Free Press, and I love the Burlington whatever it is.
I'm still he was in D.C. The fact of the matter is if there was a scandal, somebody would have happened. This is the bottom line on Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders has been, to my mind, unless there's something I don't know, he's been vetted. The problem is it's that bringing him on to a national show. Remember, he was on Ed Schultz's show on MSNBC a lot.
Yes, a lot. You're right.
And
you're
he's been on Tom Hartman
a lot.
So he's had these media places. But – the truth of the matter is that bringing him onto ABC, NBC, CBS, one of the major cable networks, is challenging because it's sort of like having, you know, like a visitor from the future or something who knows kind of how the whole thing operates.
Right.
And his willingness to talk about it is what is terrifying to him.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll give you an example.
Exactly.
I wrote an essay on Sanders in the media a while back. And he did an interview after the 2014 election, which was a disastrous election for the Democrats, with Bill Moyers. Or I was right on the eve, right around the election. And it was a stunning take. It was an hour of taking apart media, of saying, you know, this is why they
did this. I got to go find that.
Oh, yeah. It's easy to find.
I got to go find that.
It's a stunning hour. And you see it and you're like, well, of course, this is the whole thing, right? And it is kind of a matrix sort of thing.
It is a matrix.
And I think that smart people in media actually really do respect and in many cases appreciate Bernie Sanders. He has the conversations they have after the show when they're talking about the problems of media and the challenges of media.
Of course they do.
But too often, and this is my critique of media in general,
right.
We should take those conversations on air.
Exactly.
If we did, it would be a whole different country.
Exactly. And so as I'm looking at what happened yesterday, at least what I know yesterday was so valuable was the turnout was remarkable. It was really, really – and I was terrified that we might end up sort of mirroring what happened in Iowa. And that would not only be a disaster for my primary, it would be a disaster for my country.
Your state has redeemed the process.
Yes, absolutely.
And it doesn't mean that there won't be challenges. I'm not, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it has redeemed the process. The process began on Tuesday in New Hampshire. While so much of our media – this is another problem of our media, right? They're such punditized people. They're so fully punditized.
They are totally.
That they can't recognize that for a huge amount of Americans, this morning's headline, Bernie Sanders wins Vermont –
right.
Is news.
Or Bernie Sanders from Vermont wins the primary.
Wins New Hampshire.
We're both tired. Both of us are
but
tired.
Anyways, but that headline, just that's news.
Yeah.
And I was on a show this morning and they said, well, what's the story from New Hampshire? And I said, look, let's begin by the fact that a Democratic Socialist won a incredibly competitive, hard-fought primary in which he had trailed in the polls not that long ago.
Yeah, Biden was number one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Warren had been number one.
Everybody
got
to be number one.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, frankly, that a senator from Minnesota who had been an asterisk almost came in third. And that's not to diminish Pete Buttigieg, but it is to say those are the stories out of this place. And those are good stories.
Well, and the other story is Biden.
Well, I mean, that's actually a South Carolina story.
I don't know what South Carolina is. I know that. And in fact, I got yelled at, John, because the firefighters had endorsed Biden. Former governor Lynch had endorsed Biden. Carol Shea Porter, the progressive congresswoman, had endorsed Biden. I mean, Biden had a lot of endorsements early on. Here's a couple of interesting things. Lynch never opened his mouth as he watched Biden tank. All right. Carol Shea Porter, I didn't hear from her as we watched Biden tank. So they began to read the tea leaves very early on that Biden was not going to be able to carry the day. And my most important example of what happened to Joe Biden happened on the night of the 100 Club dinner. So there is a dinner just before the primary, everyone, where thousands and thousands of people come to finally see. It's a cattle call for the candidates. And all the candidates are coming in. And I didn't go to the dinner, John. I think you did.
But you can watch it on TV.
I watched it on C-SPAN. And I need to let everyone know that I started to scream at the TV. And here's why I started to scream. So Joe Biden came out to speak, okay? And he rambled. I didn't know what he was talking about. I was trying to figure out what was his message. And I was kidding people that I needed a GPS to follow Joe Biden. Because it was almost incoherent.
No, there's comedy about it now. There's literally comedy where they say that, yeah, I went down to the port and I attached a snake skin to my belt, which is the custom in the place.
That's right. Yeah, John Wayne references.
Exactly.
John Wayne references.
Well, that was horrific on Sunday.
I know.
You know, because I don't know John Wayne that well, so it sounded pretty insulting. I wrote a tweet, you know, because that's where we all show all our brilliance this morning. And I said, I want to thank Joe Biden for confirming one of the greatest, oldest tenets of journalism. You have to cover political campaigns on the ground.
Yeah.
And no matter what polls tell you, if you see a candidate who is having rallies that hardly anybody shows up to and there's no enthusiasm, that candidate's in trouble.
Yes.
And the fact is, you're talking about the former governor and these other people, they were seeing that. Right.
Yeah, everybody
and
was.
And so but the national media wasn't.
They couldn't. They didn't. And here's the thing. So I'm watching C-SPAN and you need to go and look at it. And because you were there, but you need to look at
you can't see it.
So he comes out. He does his dog and pony show and it was just sad. And then right after him, everyone go to C-SPAN and watch this. Andrew Yang comes out.
Yeah.
Now, it's not I'm not supporting Andrew Yang. I think Andrew Yang is a very interesting
now
character.
Now that he's out of the race, but, all love him.
No. But I loved him before because he speaks in a language you understand. Yeah. He talks about an experience we are living. He is today. He is present in our lives, in how we live our lives. And to watch Yang after Biden was horrific because Biden looked smaller. He looked older. He sounded more incomprehensible. I just was like, at that moment, I'm like, oh, please take him home. Please
but
take him. Don't hurt his career.
Late. Could I just ask, what took the media and everybody else so long? I told you, Arnie, on this show, the very first time Biden came to New Hampshire after he announced, he was in this very building upstairs giving a speech and to the electrical workers. And I went and I just could not believe how it sounded exactly like you just described.
Oh,
you need
God.
A GPS to know where he's going.
Exactly.
Someone asked him a question about Social Security and he's up in China talking to Xi.
They got so used to covering his fumbles, right?
Right.
That I'll give you a good example. I was covering him in 2018 at an event. And, you know, you're doing a million things. You're very, very busy. He did this speech to a bunch of students. He said, I remember when I was a student, loved the civil rights movement. Oh, we were so excited by this woman. She was from down in Mississippi and she went to the Democratic Convention and she demanded that they have representation for African Americans at the convention in 1964. And we'll never forget Emmie Lou Harris.
Emmie Lou Harris?
No.
Yeah.
It was Fannie Lou Hammer, and they also did not seat the Mississippi Freedom Party.
So I'm sitting next to a guy who
I said
to the guy, did he just say Emmie Lou Harris? Because I'm not, And he said, I think he did. And then Biden keeps talking, and about like a minute later, he goes, and never forget the lesson of Emmie Lou Harris. And you know what the thing is?
I want that commercial. I want that commercial. That's a commercial. I hate to break it to you in South Carolina.
Like that happened every speech. At a certain point, I think a lot of media folks said, oh, well, he does these things. You know, let's try and see if we can find some bit of substance in here. The trouble was, what a lot of media folks, especially D.C. types, what they didn't understand was the American people actually were seeing it
of course
all along.
They were.
And they
of
had made their decision.
They
and they were all
theirs.
Blind for the same reason. They really wanted Biden to win because they really believed for some reason that Biden could beat Trump.
No, that's not true. I think what they wanted was they were channeling Barack Obama. And so what happened was they didn't want about Biden. It wasn't really Biden. It was that they wanted what Barack brought, which was less craziness.
That's what they wanted.
It was nostalgia for an era.
But do you know what the problem is? I think both of you are right in many ways. It was nostalgia, but it was also they wanted somebody who could beat Trump. And the assumption is the Obama imprimatur would be so important.
They believed he could beat Trump.
Well, they did.
In spite of what they saw.
I'm going to just say two words that complete the thought. Mike Bloomberg. Because now they are going to – they aren't going to learn a lesson. I promise. They do not learn lessons. Guaranteed. They are going to transfer it over to Mike Bloomberg.
We'll talk about Pete in the second half of the show. So don't move, John Nicholson, in case our phone system is really down.
Oh, no.
When we come back, I'm hoping that we're going to get Bob Hennelly from New York, who knows more about Michael Bloomberg than any human being on the planet, I think.
Exactly.
So we're going to be continuing the conversation. If we don't get Bob, John Nicholson will continue to stay here. And Scott Braddock, I'm hoping from Texas, will join the conversation. A little ACLU Minute is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
Can it really be a federal crime to save people who otherwise will die of dehydration and exposure? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The United States government insisted that the answer is yes when it prosecuted individuals in Arizona who belonged to the Unitarian Universalist Church and its humanitarian aid organization ministry, No More Deaths, No Más Muertes. The members of No More Deaths leave supplies, food, water, and medicine in the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, which borders Mexico, along footpaths used by persons entering the United States without legal permission. It's one of the most extreme environments in North America and has no safe drinking water. According to the Pima County Medical Examiner, 2,816 sets of, quote, undocumented border crosser remains, end quote, were recovered in Arizona between 2000 and 2017. The defendants claim protection from prosecution under the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And on January 31st, the federal district court in Arizona found that their religious beliefs were sincere and that prosecuting them by the government was not necessary to achieve the government's legitimate goals. The court rejected the government's final justification that more deaths could mean fewer crossings as gruesome logic, totally speculative and unsupported by evidence. The court then dismissed the criminal charges of driving and being and leaving water in the refuge in a victory for conscience and religious freedom in America. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself. Did you know that when you vote for president, you're actually not voting for your candidate?
I'm Tom Hartman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Sorry if this is unsettling news, but what's really happening is that you're voting for electors to the Electoral College who have pledged to vote for your candidate and will, presumably, if your candidate wins the popular vote. It's a winner-take-all system, usually statewide, although in Maine and Nebraska, each congressional district decides one electoral vote. But sometimes, electors don't vote as they had promised to do. Indeed, in 2016, 7 so-called faithless electors, 5 pledged to Trump and 2 to Clinton, jumped ship and voted for neither of those candidates, which didn't matter because the Electoral College vote wasn't that close. But in another year, a switch in a handful of electoral votes could actually decide who becomes president. In 2000, for example, the final Electoral College vote was 271 for Bush, 266 for Gore. Historical precedent supports the idea that electors indeed can change their mind and vote for whoever they please. That said, the Supreme Court, which previously has never decided this issue, has just taken a case from Washington State which raises it precisely. A decision is expected by June, way better, to be sure, than the case being before the court in November, when the electoral outcome could hang in the balance.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because democracy and advocacy begin with you, and freedom can't defend itself.
You called me last night on the telephone, and I was glad to hear from you, because I was all alone. You said, it's snowing, God, I hate this weather. Now I walk through blizzards just to get us back together. We met in the springtime at a rock and roll show. It was on the Bowery when it was time to go. We kissed on the subway in the middle of the night. I held your hand, you held mine. It was the best night of my life. 'Cause everyone's your friend in New York City, and everything looks beautiful when you're young and pretty. The streets are paved with diamonds, and there's just so much to see. But the best thing about New York City is you and me.
Everyone, the best thing about New York City is probably now us and Michael Bloomberg. Maybe not the best. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes picks our music. Of course, this is my absolute favorite group on the planet, so tell them who sings this song.
This might be Giants.
Oh, I love them.
As in the New York Giants, because they're singing
them.
About New York.
I love them. All right, everyone. So this is a really crazy half hour. So on the line with us right now is Bob Hennelly. Bob Hennelly writes for The Chief Leader. Bob Hennelly covers Michael Bloomberg, or has covered Michael Bloomberg since his earliest days in New York. He has been with WNYC. He is at Stuck Nation. He writes for Salon.com and has a regular op-ed piece. And we called him because the last thing that John Nichols, who's also in my studio, and Scott Braddock now, the voice of Texas, the Quorum Report, is also in my studio. This is what happens when you have the presidential primary in your state. So you are surrounded by remarkable minds, Bob Hennelly. And of course, so are you. But the last thing that John Nichols said was Michael Bloomberg. And it was almost like he was channeling your arrival on the scene. So as we watched what happened yesterday, Bob Hennelly, let me tell you something that I had predicted. And what I had predicted was with Michael Bloomberg, even though he wasn't quote-unquote running in New Hampshire, I said, watch for the write-ins.
Right.
And what he did was frickin' brilliant. because there's a little town called Dixville Notch on the Canadian border. Dixville Notch had a total of 5 votes and was going to get the headline the morning of the New Hampshire primary. And I don't know how many people took people out to dinner in Dixville Notch that were on the Bloomberg payroll. But the people in Dixville Notch, of which there are 5 voters, 3 of the 5 voters voted for whom? Michael Bloomberg. And I'm just going to tell you right now, Michael Bloomberg got more free media out of that Dixville Notch 3 votes than any human being on the planet. And even though he can buy all the media, even though he wasn't playing in the New Hampshire primary, Bob Hennelly, he actually won the New Hampshire primary because he got the first headline and the first win. And where did it come? It came on the Canadian border where people have never been to New York City. So I just want to let you know, it was genius.
It's
called
ROI, Arnie.
ROI?
Return on investment.
Return on investment.
Must have been a heck of a dinner, huh?
That's right. A couple of meals and look what you got. Look what you got. All right. So, John, before we get you and Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, and, of course, John Nichols from The Nation magazine. So, Bob Hennelly, as you are watching what's going on and you're also seeing the news spilling out about Bloomberg, even as the New Hampshire primary is basically sort of calling the shots, you know, Bernie Sanders wins, Mayor Pete second, Amy Klobuchar third, Biden toast. What are you seeing from a perspective of having covered Bloomberg and how this race is going to then sort of be transferred, I mean, not just to Nevada and South Carolina, but as it moves on to Super Tuesday?
Well, across all 50 states, the army of Michael Bloomberg's supported mayors and people that throughout his tenure he supported in all manner, ready to spring to action. And I would say it will be similar to the March of the Wooden Soldiers and the Babes of Toyland. Each day now, waves and waves of these people, Democrats will come forward to say that he is the last best hope for capitalism in our time.
And as you were saying that, right as this story was rolling out about stop and frisk, which is incredibly devastating, I think it was from a talk he gave at the Aspen Institute, but whatever it is, and it was a Bernie Sanders a person who found it, but it's his words, and he can't not, right, you know, not acknowledge it. Will you let everyone know, as you were talking about the soldiers coming out in support of Bernie Sanders, we've been seeing a number of black mayors and mayors coming out from him, but tell us who came out today in order to step on that story. Because geography matters, race matters, and location matters. So tell the audience who came out.
No, you got to tell me because you're smarter than I am. That's why you're the host.
Okay.
I don't have a clue.
The clue is Georgia Congresswoman. A black congresswoman mm-hmm. from Georgia came out today.
Stacey Abrams.
Not Stacey Abrams. This is a black.
McBath.
Yeah, McBath came out today to endorse Bloomberg.
And I sent it to you.
You're so funny.
Anybody that the reality is, if you lived here through that time and covered him, it was apartheid with guns. Like, it's not playing around. There are thousands of African-American young men whose lives were ruined.
Right.
And it created a racial divide, which has just barely begun to heal. It produced a whole generation of new city council people. It resulted in something I never thought I'd see at whatever it was around the 50s at the time, a convergence of a coalition of majority-minority politicians that had skillfully been played off each other for years come together.
Right.
So, yes, Michael Bloomberg and his racism bringing the city together. Also, just for fiscal conservatives who hold on to Mike as their best hope, I documented $1 billion in payouts for bad police behavior. Of course, the city admitted no wrongdoing over the 12 years that he was there. That's right, $1 billion in tort claim payouts. I don't see that in any of his ads. Do you?
No. You're absolutely right. But it's so interesting to me, from the win in Dixville Notch to the stories that are coming out today, and now the Georgia Congresswoman. I have in my studio Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, which is one of the most well-read political newsletters in the state of Texas. He also is called the dean of the Austin Press Corps. But more importantly, one of the things that I heard from Scott Braddock is, where did Mayor Bloomberg really begin in his campaign for president? Because this also is incredibly telling. So, Scott, why don't you share with our audience where he started?
Where he started?
Didn't he start in Austin, Texas?
Well, he was along what we now call the Blue Spine of Texas, which is the I-35 corridor from the Valley up to DFW.
Yeah.
And look, he's fishing where the votes are in Texas. I mean, he has – and by the way – tomorrow in Houston. He'll be at the Harris County Democratic parties. Their big fundraiser dinner that they have every year. I'm old enough to remember when they had to beg people to come talk to the Harris County Democrats in Houston. And now all the presidential candidates, want to be there, including Bloomberg. He'll be there, of course, with the black mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner.
Right.
He's there working it. I mean, Harris County, where Houston is one-fifth of the electorate in Texas. So 30 million people live there,
right.
254 counties across two time zones.
Right.
But you got to be in those urban centers. He's doing that. And, in the Wall Street Journal, they reported in December that Bloomberg had spent one ad buy, just in the Houston market, $1 million.
Oh,
he raised ad rates across the Houston market 45% just with that one purchase, which, of course, also crowds out other people who want to do anything, right?
Oh,
it changes the whole game. I mean, they have had, in Texas, a drought of staffers for Democratic campaigns because for 20, 25 years, you could not make a living as a Democratic staffer working on campaigns in Texas, right? Now, I was at an event a couple of weeks ago, and junior staffers who have maybe worked one or two legislative race campaigns, they're making $10,000, $12,000 a month.
Yep.
Through March.
Wow.
And some of them have been promised that that's going to continue.
So
through
let me
November,
offer.
Because he says
it
will continue.
Okay, so I'm
going to
get John Nichols and then Bobby go back to you.
Let me just, because now we're going to do one-upmanship, okay?
One-upmanship.
Yeah,
this is good. See what Bob's done? Yes.
All right, because I love, Texas always thinks it's the biggest.
We are.
The best,
yeah.
And all that
well,
stuff
we're the
like
biggest.
That.
That's for sure.
But I come from Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin is actually where this thing will play out.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Because Super Tuesday
Milwaukee.
Will, it's going to, Texas and other states are going to prove that I think the Bloomberg thing is a juggernaut that's kind of real and something
you've got
to watch out for.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Then you
got
to get out to Wisconsin, which has an early April primary. And I suspect it's going to be Bernie Sanders and Mike Bloomberg going at each other.
Right,
sure.
Right.
And so this is what I know.
Okay.
On the square in Madison around the Capitol, lovely place with cheese shops and things, there was a huge open space, beautiful spot, where probably the prime campaign headquarters spot in Wisconsin. Last week I'm walking down the street.
Bloomberg
office.
It's a
Bloomberg. And
location.
They have hired more than 60 Wisconsin Democratic operatives. More than 60 at the wages that Scott was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the interesting thing. They have the former chairman of the state party. They have the immediate former spokesman for the state party.
Mm-hmm.
They have multiracial,
multi-ethnic
staff.
Yep. Right.
And they are getting well paid, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
But they are already meeting with all the papers. They're doing physically, without a grassroots, but they're doing physically the reality of a campaign in all of these states.
Yes.
And all these other candidates are like going, heading out. Can we get to Keene? Is it going to snow on the mountain
exactly,
over there? Yeah.
Exactly.
Right? And
exactly.
And Bloomberg's out there saying, well, let's meet with the editorial boards here,
Well, so let me ask you a question, Bob. Here's my greatest fear. So if Bernie Sanders either gets trashed or gets no traction at all in the national media, will they do a real analysis of Michael Bloomberg? Will the kind of information you just shared about what happened with in New York City, about the $1 billion in payouts for cops that basically had done things that probably should have gotten them arrested, will the stories that you know ever rise to a place where anyone will read them except at Salon.com, and I'm hoping in John Nichols, and I'm hoping on my airwaves? Because this is part of the concern, is that not only does Michael Bloomberg buy his ads, not only does he buy his credibility, but I think he ensures that the national media doesn't cover him the way they should, in part because the Washington Post wants him to win and Bloomberg News he owns. So think about those two things buffering him on top of his billions. And I am really worried that we will know nothing about Mayor Bloomberg.
I just have to share with you my 12 years of covering him, where my colleague Andrea Bernstein and I would trade off chances to go to Third Avenue to Gellerco, the accounting offices of the mayor's vast empire, and Stu Lozier would sit over there and they'd hand out this phony disclosure thing where there were supposed to be amounts for taxes paid. There would be alphabetical values, A through G. A would be under 5,000 and G would be over 500,000. So you're looking at a volume the size of a small Midwestern city phone book with G.
Which makes it better.
Now, I started tracking this guy. Now, remember, I had a great run at WNYC, but I only had to bring my scripts down to be reviewed by the general counsel when we started tracking the proliferation of Michael Bloomberg's things like Bloomberg Island Cayman LLC. Like, wow. What is that?
Yeah.
Right. So what I'm concerned about is that because of the Journalist Full Employment Program and the unique Haley's Comet event of hundreds of millions of dollars going to publicly traded media companies from Mike Bloomberg,
they may
not hold him to the same standard as Mussolini in the White House and ask for his taxes.
Well, so let me just say that about his taxes. So let's remind our audience that when he first ran for mayor in 2002 as a Republican, since he could only buy into the Republican Party because the Democratic Party would not allow him in.
They were for sale at that point.
They were for sale at that point. Well, the Republican Party didn't really exist in New York City.
They're cheap.
So they came cheap. Mm. But one of the things I was reading about the other day, Bob, is that when they were – everybody else had showed their tax returns. And they asked Michael Bloomberg for his tax returns. And my understanding is that what Michael Bloomberg said is, oh, tisk, tisk. I make more money than everyone running against me. They're too complicated. I'm not going to bother.
No, it was worse than that.
Oh,
what he
worse?
Said was, I have him on tape on this, and I'm trying to get this tape into circulation, but it's going to be hard. I asked him about Bloomberg Island LLC. And he was like, I have people all over the world. I have to be registered in these countries to do business. It's a global world. Like, that's all he has to say. And he picked, by the way, keeping his taxes secret. The whole excuse was because it would be a proprietary advantage to his competitors while he was the mayor of the city of New York. And I'm sad to say, I'm calling you from Room 9 in City Hall, looking up at Henry Clay, a white man in oil. And guess what? Nobody pushed back. And now he's running for president. I feel as a New Yorker, New Jersey, that area, I have a responsibility because we have, let's see, tabloid creatures we've sicked on the American people unsuspectingly.
Yeah.
Right. Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani. Yeah. So we have to do from our marginal positions as best we can to give people the 411 and Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah. So John, as I'm listening to him say this, I posted on Facebook, Scott and John and Bob, the fact that he had not produced his tax returns. And everyone said, oh, no big deal. Donald Trump
hasn't
produced.
Yeah.
Right. So I said, now listen to that response. These are progressive Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I said to them, so Trump has now set the non-existent standard. We have now decided that whatever Trump is doing, therefore we are legitimate in being able to do the same thing. So we are mirroring his unethical, illegal behavior because he gets away with it.
Let me do something here and do this just like shamelessly suck up to the host. The other day, Arnie, you said
I never do that, Arnie.
Something.
Oh, you know,
because you're a better man than I. Yeah.
I did not say that.
But you know who's sitting closer to the host with a better man.
Yeah, that's how
stuff is. So here's bottom line. The other day we were talking, and he said something that I immediately wrote, put it in the Nation magazine. He said, people are exhausted.
Yeah,
4 years
mm-hmm.
of opposing right. Donald Trump is pretty exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you got this guy who comes along and says, hey, I got this. I'll pay for it all. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I got a lot of money. We'll be fine. And unfortunately, I think that is as big a deal as any of the other stuff we're
exactly
talking about here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Bloomberg is taking full advantage of it and, you know, trying to create a sense of inevitability. And the important thing to understand is what we're hearing from our friend here in New York.
From Bob.
But also, I one of the things I've been tracking on Bloomberg is this. Do you know that when you become the mayor of a city, any mm-hmm. city, like probably over 20,000,
right.
you and your chief of staff are offered Bloomberg Urban Leadership Scholarships.
Yes.
What this involves is you fly to New York City,
right.
all paid.
Yep.
You get even your Lyft is paid for.
Mm-hmm.
Stay in a great hotel.
Yep.
You spend a week there with Harvard experts and all sorts of people. You even get to have your picture taken with Mike Bloomberg.
Yep.
And then they keep you in a program, a training program,
right.
to train you to be a better mayor or a better chief of staff. What I want to emphasize is Mike Bloomberg has created a web across this country
exactly.
of people who are in reliant on him,
right.
but also in sort of intimate interaction with him on a regular basis. This is why it is going to be so hard
right.
to break through all this, because you got these people who say, well, yeah, but look at the good he's done.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
mm-hmm.
it's – the fact of the matter is there's one person – who is on top of all this.
Bernie.
There's one person who's on top of all this
who's got the data, who knows how to investigate people in New York City, and is waiting for Michael Bloomberg to be his opponent in November, and that's Donald Trump.
Oh, right. So let's just say something, though, because Scott and Bob, but that's actually true about both of them. If anyone knows where the bodies are in New York City vis-a-vis Donald Trump, it is Michael Bloomberg. And it's not just because he was mayor. Am I right, Bob? I mean, when you realize Bloomberg News is where all the information is crunched. Bloomberg News. Go on.
I know you're on a roll, but the thing that's really striking, because I came up at the Village Voice when Tim O'Brien was there working with Wayne Barrett.
Right.
Yeah. What's really kind of disconcerting is Tim is an amazing journalist who's done great breakthrough work on Donald Trump. He suffered tremendously under the lashes of the abuse of Donald Trump, and he can be abusive. I've interviewed him. He can be abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And now Tim's in the campaign for Mayor Bloomberg, and they're not even responding. You try to ask him about the income tax relief. And moreover, this is what's very cynical on their part. They filed, as Politico reported, to delay and get an extension to file their required SEC, Federal Election Commission, disclosure forms till after Super Tuesday. How in the world, and I want somebody like Harry Melfer, somebody that's going to have access to these people, to ask, how can you be the leader of the free world if you can't get your prerequisite homework in on time like the other people?
Well, and not only that, but let's also remember that there is no FEC. The Federal Election Commission is castrated. They can't even get a quorum. So I understand.
The one thing they do is file the forms. Other candidates do.
I agree. And this
Trump
is
had a,
go on, Scott.
On that point, Trump had an appointee to the FEC, a guy named Trey Traynor, who was also an attorney for some of the biggest dark money groups in Texas, and they just sat that one out. He was never confirmed.
Wow.
On this Bloomberg thing, I would say this. It used to be that Texas politics was national politics. That's when we used to export our problems to Washington. Now it's the other way around.
Yeah.
And because of the infrastructure that Bloomberg is creating, he's filling a vacuum where the DNC is a mess.
Right.
The Texas Democratic Party is a mess. I know that's the case in other places as well.
He's paying for it.
And he's coming in and he's doing that. And I never thought that I would live to see the day that a billionaire developer from Manhattan would be the preferred candidate of Texas Republicans. Yeah. But he got so much in free media, Trump did, and the way that you move the needle in an electorate as big as Texas, 16 million registered voters, we're north of that now, you have to do it that way. Bloomberg's the only one who can do that that way on the Democratic side, and so maybe we'll see a billionaire from New York also be the preferred candidate of Texas Democrats.
So I think the point that Scott just made is really important, and maybe this is something, Bob, that you could spend some time doing, and that is that when I looked at the Democratic National Committee, and then I realized how he basically funded them. He funded every foundation, every arm of the DCCC, like $800,000 here, $400,000 there, $500,000 there. I mean, I don't know what else he's done.
It's called party rental. It's right there.
Party rental.
That's the headline.
But the party rental, Scott Braddock just pointed out, that is going to be the case in every party. Every party is starved for money. They don't have it. And what he's doing is not only buying the operatives on the ground, and that is also scary too, because if people are trying to compete with the best people, you have to start asking.
He's hiring all the people that know all the media, know all the structure on the ground.
Right.
And if I can offer just one other notion, we did a book a couple years ago or some years back called Dollarocracy. We developed a metric for analyzing how much a rich person spends as compared to the income of a working class person.
Right.
At this point in his campaign, what we know that's been spent by Mike Bloomberg is the equivalent of a nice dinner for a working class family.
Right.
This money he's spending is so irrelevant to him. It is such a minor amount of his wealth. And people – I honestly don't think – that people fully – average person fully understands what a 52 billionaire is.
No.
But the people who do understand that are political party operatives.
Exactly.
But how can we – the good guys, of course – get that information out, John?
So that the public
it where the public actually reads it.
But that's where Bob comes in, because, Bob, you talked about his tax returns that he refused to show. One of the reasons why, Bob, I think the story about the tax returns is so important, Donald Trump gave the wealthiest – Americans a huge tax cut in 2017. What I would like to know is how many millions and millions of dollars did Michael Bloomberg benefit from the tax cuts given to him by Donald Trump? Because I suspect the pocket change he is spending for this campaign actually is because Donald Trump produced them in the way of tax cuts. But the only way we can do that, go on.
I would say that one of the things that is problematic is that there are many younger Americans who might think, because of the frequency of Michael Bloomberg's ads, in such intimate proximity to President Obama, that he actually was vice president. The reality here is that what has to come out, and this is going to be tough for the Democratic Party, because they didn't want to do it, but the Obama years have to be litigated.
Yes.
Because the reality is what set Donald Trump up, it was the reporting and all of this did in places like Cleveland, 6,000 empty homes. African Americans got the White House and they lost their own home.
Right.
The decrepitude of the national economy for working class people, three out of the last 4 years, the decline in the average American life expectancy, increasing levels of, as it was written in the Times, related to these deaths related to despair and suicide. Mm-hmm. This country is in crisis. And the problem here is that we're not going to get to how Mayor Bloomberg made his money, which is through the gross financialization of the planet that has now resulted in everything being turned into a transaction where we have these young people shackled to $1.7 trillion in debt.
Exactly.
The global debt empire, and this is funny, every time President Obama tried to do some milquetoast reform on banking, Mayor Bloomberg held press conferences to oppose it.
And you have evidence of that?
I have. My wife thinks I'm crazy keeping all this stuff.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden, it's like relevant.
Yes, yes. Well, I think this is important. And let me, what you just said is so powerful, because I have talked about the fact that when Barack Obama won, he won on hope and change. And what happened is that, you know, the hope ended up being for Wall Street and finance, because they were able to return to stability. What never happened was the hope for the rest of us. And I said, and when you look over the 8 years and you look at the gap between rich and poor and you look at what happened to people with the affordability issues, you begin to realize exactly what you said. And I said that on the air. Mm. And I got attacked in a way that you could not even imagine. I am not allowed to litigate what happened in those 8 years. We are not allowed to dissect what happened in the 8 years, because 8 years of Barack Obama produced in part Donald Trump. And it wasn't just because of racism, which is the easy card to throw out there. It was
some of it, though.
Well, no, there's some of it.
There's plenty of it.
No, no, but it's,
come down to Texas with me.
Yeah, he'll show you that.
All right, John.
But Arnie, you don't have to, you know,
this
is the thing. The truth of the matter is that Barack Obama was disempowered after 2 years in office by an election result. And more importantly, I would argue he was disempowered by a Democratic Party that had over many, many years become so dysfunctional and so reliant on money that when you got – actually, I think a young president who really wanted to do a lot of good things, the party just – it isn't there to make things happen.
Yeah.
And this is – circle around to the start of our conversation here. This is something Bernie Sanders talked about a lot.
Yeah.
He really wants to create something new, and there's a lot of people in the Democratic Party who are horrified by that, and here's where the subtlety comes in. Given a choice between Bernie Sanders saying, I want to bring in a lot of young people who really believe in this, or a billionaire saying, you know what? I'm going to hire all you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm going to keep all you guys here.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. All right, Bob Henley, you have the last line in this. I did not intend to have all these people in the conversation, but it just made it so much richer. So what are your thoughts as you sort of see what's going on as we go into, like, South Carolina, we go into Nevada, but more importantly into Super Tuesday?
I think we just have to keep focused on demanding disclosure.
Yes.
If he really wants to show us he's a different kind of billionaire, just show your taxes. And we can move on to talk about climate change and all the issues that you want to, you know, bring forward. Without that, though, there really can't be a discussion, because in 2020, it's a question of whether or not the formation of great wealth is going to be on the ballot or on the ballot.
Oh, I love you. All right, Bob Henley, he writes for Salon.com. You can find him at Stuck Nation. He writes for The Chief Leader. If you want to know about Michael Bloomberg, you better follow Bob Henley. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
All right. Goodbye, Scott Braddock, Voice of Texas. Bye-bye. We'll talk to you tomorrow. John Nichols, you'll be joining us a lot. John Nichols of The Nation magazine. Thank you for being in studio. And then how do we end this show, Monsieur?
Well, we talked about the lack of a decent wage. It's called The Minimum Wage by B.K. Anderson.
Here we go.
You work each day half around the clock. You get your pay, but you're still in hock. Your jeans are clean and there ain't a cent. The landlord comes, but the rent is spent. Oh, the minimum wage, the minimum wage, it's a sin. The minimum wage. You sweat and slave till you're 65 and get a minimum pension if you're still alive. And you come home beat. It's rough, it's tough, but you've got to eat. The rich get rich and the poor stay poor. You're sick, 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 and there ain't a cure. Oh, the minimum wage, the minimum wage, it's a sin. The minimum wage. You sweat and slave till you're 65 and get a minimum pension if you're still alive. The day you die, they'll engrave your stone. Here lies a guy, but he is not alone. He might have lived his maximum age.